Well, this is a wonderful, wonderful book.
Well, thank you.
I've been reading it steadily. I'm almost finished with the book, and I find it almost impossible to put down. But I guess, in a way, since you started working on this book a long time ago and you were looking for an ending, it was almost like Capote, as you point out in your book, Capote. Capote was looking for an ending for In Cold Blood because he didn't know how his two main characters were going to wind up, for sure. So he had to wait on that book. And in a way, you had to wait with Capote, didn't you?
Yes, that has occurred to me since I finished the book, that I had to wait for something. I don't want to be macabre about it, though. What I had to wait for didn't have to be his death. It could have had a happier ending. There were times that it appeared that he would pull out of the tailspin he was going through. For instance, in 1979, when he was writing Music for Chameleons, his last book, which I think is a marvelous book, he was quite sober. He was he was in control of himself. And it looked to those of us who were close to him that things would be all right.
I remember that when that book came out.
An underrated book, I think. It got mixed reviews. It got some very good reviews, some wonderful reviews. In fact, John Fowles, the English novelist, compared him to Maupassant and Proust. And you can't get much better than that. But then it got mixed reviews other places. I think
it was time to dump on Capote anyway.
I'm afraid so. People got the impression that he was a clown, that he was a drunk, and he was a drunk, of course.
They did that with Tennessee Williams. Why doesn't he write good plays anymore?
I know. We have a tendency to destroy people we raise up. Why haven't you done this? I was with Truman a great deal. We lived close to each other on Long Island, eastern Long Island, about 2 miles away. And I used to see him a great deal. We got into the habit of having lunch at Bobby Van's in Bridgehampton. And he would then come back to my house, and we'd talk sometimes for 6 or 7 hours. He would come back at 2:30 and stay until 7 or thereabouts, and then go home and have dinner. And we did this frequently, and even when he had lunch with other people, he would sometimes come back to my house, unannounced usually, alas, and we'd talk some more. So I saw a great, great deal of him, and I was with him many times when people would come up and ask him how his famous unfinished novel, Answered Prayers, was coming along. And I could see that weak, sick smile of his that authors have when people ask questions like that. And I felt for him because I had the same problem, in a sense, because I was so long writing this book, 12 years, and people would ask me, well, how's it going? And I'd see this kind of smirk on their faces, and I had to control myself from strangling them. But I smiled back, and I always said, fine, fine, fine. And eventually it did come out, of course.
Well, you mentioned the Music for Chameleons. The last time I saw Capote was at Brentano's bookstore. I went over, and he was autographing books. And I had a couple of books I thought I would ask him to autograph for me. For some reason, we didn't get together for an interview. But I walked over there, and they had, I don't know if you were in the store that day, but they had a force of security guards, and there were people lined through that store and out onto the sidewalk.
For Truman?
For Truman, to get him to sign a copy of his book. And I wasn't going to line up. I had no idea it was going to be a madhouse like that. So I just pushed my way toward the front. Brentano's had a little store off to the side where they used to have prints, you might remember.
Yes,
artwork,
I do.
Sure, like that. And that's where they had Truman. So as I was about to enter the room, of course I wasn't in the line with all the autograph seekers, a security person came up to me and says, you can't enter this room unless you have a press card. And of course I did have a press card, but I didn't. At this time it looked like such a circus. But I could see Truman. He was on a little platform, and he was sitting there signing books, and one after another, after another, after another.
Truman inspired a great deal of affection from people. I would walk along the streets of Manhattan with him, And truck drivers and taxi drivers and other people would yell out the windows of their cars or their trucks or their taxis, "Hey, Truman! Hey, Truman!" And it was done with great affection. It wasn't any nastiness. I've reported on many other celebrities and also walked the streets with them, and sometimes people say something. New Yorkers are pretty blasé about this sort of thing, but sometimes people would say something, sometimes not. But I never got the same feeling of affection that they had for Truman. And I think the reason was that they identified with him in some curious way. They understood and recognized his vulnerability. And the vulnerability that they themselves have, that we all have. Truman was unlike anyone else in the world. But yet, there was something about him that was universal, that really touched people's hearts. And I think that's why there were such long lines in front of Brentano's, and that's why...
Of course, he was a celebrity, too, unlike most writers.
He appeared
on talk shows all the time. He was instantly visible, and he was funny and amusing.
Yes, that's true.
So he actually had two worlds. He had a literary world, and he had a world of celebrity.
He had that, of course, and he loved the celebrity. In a sense, he was a victim of celebrity. He became addicted to it. I think fame is as serious an addiction as cocaine or alcohol or coffee or cigarettes or anything else. And Truman became addicted to fame. And if his picture was in the paper, he was happy. And that's kind of sad for a writer. It's understandable, but it's still...
Oh, they all like it, except for Salinger.
They all like it, but I don't think they have the same kind of addiction Truman had. Part of it was that he couldn't help himself, that people, writers and photographers, were attracted to Truman, and they always had been. Even if he did nothing, people wrote about him. He was just so unusual, so peculiar. He was, if anybody had a natural sense of publicity, it was Truman Capote.
Well, let's go back a little bit and tell me about the origins of this wonderful biography and how you came to start writing it.
I had written a series of profiles of writers in the early 70s for Esquire and the Atlantic magazines, including Gore Vidal and Nabokov and P.G. Woodhouse and people like that. And Truman was one of them. And this was my piece on Truman ran in 1972. And we kept in touch, and a couple of years later, a publisher asked me to write a biography, and I called Truman up and asked if he would cooperate. And it took him just a few seconds, and he said, yes. He didn't seem enthusiastic about it, but he said yes nonetheless. And we both thought it would take a short time. By short time, I mean 2 years. I think that's the minimum time you can do this sort of thing. And for myself, I had very good reasons for thinking it could be done quickly. One was Truman had been interviewed extensively from the time he was about 20 years old. He had been interviewed and photographed more than any other writer of his generation, here or anywhere else in the world, I believe. And he had been very outspoken, and he had spoken about everything. He was also accessible to me. He was friendly. He promised to help, and he did. And I was a fairly fast writer, and I thought, well, this will be duck soup. We'll have a lot of good lunches and wonderful restaurants in New York.
And you could supplement your own interviews with Capote with all of the other
material. Mm-hmm. In other words, I knew the lay of the land, and I knew that there was a wealth of material about Truman. So I thought it would be an easy thing to do and great fun. But what I didn't realize, and what poor Truman didn't realize either, was that he was entering about that time the most dramatic period of his life, which also turned out to be the tragic end of his life, the last few years. I started writing and started researching before the famous story Lecote Basque was published, which was in the fall of 1975. And during the summer of 1975, we were out on Long Island, and one day he took me swimming at a friend's pool. And as I sat on the side of the pool reading the story, Lecote Basque, he paddled around. And at the end, he explained to me who the models for each of the characters were. And I knew some of them. Some of them were quite obvious, and some of them were not. But he told me who everyone was supposed to be. And I recall saying to him, "Truman, they're not going to be very happy when they read this." And he was lying on his back, floating in the pool, looking up at the cloudless July sky, and said, "Nah, they're too dumb. They won't know who they are." Well, 3 months later, it was proven how wrong he was, because, of course, they did know who they were. And it was as if an earthquake had opened up on the east side of Manhattan. Suddenly, his world just crumbled. He was in California at the time, and the phone lines just started buzzing between all over the east side of Manhattan, from New York to California. And his world just disintegrated. All the high society people, all the international jet set types, with very few exceptions, just dropped him instantly. And some of them were his great, great friends, like Mrs. Paley, who's now dead, who was the wife of the chairman of CBS. But they dropped him instantly, and it devastated him. And the question is, why did he do this? Because surely he couldn't have thought they were really that dumb. And I have several theories about it. One of them is that he was like a child who was trying to see how much he could get away with. He had been enveloped by this society. He had been taken up. He had been lionized. He had just reached the very peak, higher than any writer could imagine going. He thought he was omnipotent, in a sense. In fact, one of the newspapers once said, half jokingly, "Truman Capote is omnipotent." Well, he found out he was not omnipotent.
Did this make your work harder when this disaster, personal disaster for him?
Well, a few people after that would not talk to me, yes, who might have talked to me before that. They just refused. So in that sense, it made my work harder. It also helped to create this trauma that he was going through, because it accelerated the decline which had already started, which I wasn't fully aware of, and he certainly wasn't fully aware of it. It made him drink more heavily and take pills more and just do everything more. He was truly devastated by it. So that went on and on and on, and I had no ending to the story.
Now, had you finished a manuscript?
No, I hadn't finished. I had really barely begun the research at this time, but I had certainly expected to be finished soon. But every time I started going someplace, finishing chapters, something dramatic would happen. Truman would be in a hospital. He would suffer an attack. He would go on the offensive against some of his former friends, like Gore Vidal, like Lee Radziwill. He would make himself very public. So there was no end to the story. In other words, you can write a biography of a living person, and you don't have to wait for the person's death. Most writers you can name today, you could write a biography of and finish. John Updike.
Why don't you do one of Salinger?
Thank you very much.
I just was talking to Ian Hamilton last week about his Salinger book, and you know, here the Capote book is such a definitive volume, and it gives almost every facet of Capote's life. And the Salinger book is so thin. It doesn't tell you very much. Years and years of gaps. You just don't know anything about Salinger. Not much more than when you began. Not the case with Capote.
Well, you see, that's why I asked Truman if he would cooperate. Because, of course, you can write a biography of someone without the person's cooperation. It's done all the time. And that's what he did with Salinger. But I wouldn't find it much fun, and I wouldn't find it very interesting to do. So I would not have done that. I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, that Salinger is all that interesting, whereas I think Truman was interesting. I think Salinger's writing was interesting. But
Wrote four books, actually one novel.
Well, I know that, but I think nonetheless it was interesting at the time, that little bit, but I just don't know that there's enough there to write a biography. After all, he's lived as a recluse for how many years? 25 years? Yeah, 30 years?
Something like that.
What possibly can you say except that he's up in New Hampshire looking at the snow?
That's almost precisely what Hamilton's biography did say. And I asked him when he left, I said, did you learn your lesson? He said, yeah, I sure did. And it was blocked up by litigation. But back to Capote, after his death, did you find that you had to take a different tack with the book?
No. I had finished about half of it when he died, and I really did not change things. I found out a few things that I had not known before. A few papers became available to me, and I had to go back and make a few revisions for that. But they were technical things. They were details. They were certainly not in terms of the characters or my evaluation of Capote. In other words, I did not soften his character make his character more realistic after he died. I said exactly what I would have said had he still been alive.
The people who didn't want to talk to you during his lifetime, were you able to go back and get interviews with them?
A few talked to me afterwards, and a few called me up and said they would talk, and a few were more open. Because, you see, many people were still afraid of him. They were afraid of retaliation, even in his bad state. He had a pretty mean tongue, and he could say things that were very hurtful, and they were remembered. You remember, Truman was the one who once said that Jack Kerouac didn't write. He was a typewriter. That's not writing, he said. That's typewriting. And that stuck with Kerouac. It was like a tattoo.
Capote was right.
Capote was probably right, of course. But even in Kerouac's obituaries, that's always mentioned. So Truman had a vivid way of phrasing things that people were afraid of. Also, a lot of them hated him and did not want to talk or help me while he was alive, and so few did afterwards. But there were no basic changes. He told me when I began that he wanted me to tell the truth, and he would not respect me if I didn't tell the truth. And that sounds a little corny, but I think he actually meant it, because he was a professional in regard to writing. He was until the day he died, and he was writing something when he died that was really quite good. So his writing did not deteriorate. But by professional, I mean that he respected writing, and he respected other writers, and he respected what I was doing. And he did not want me to sugarcoat anything. Whether he would have been happy with the book, I can't really say. I'm sure that there are some parts in there that would cause him pain and he would not like. However, I like to think that in the main he would appreciate it and like it.
He seemed to flaunt, at least in his early days, his homosexuality. And one thing I was...
He couldn't hide it, really. It wasn't that he flaunted it. It was just something he couldn't hide.
But I was, in reading Capote, I was so surprised to see how large the homosexual world was in the arts. Because Jack Cassidy, Montgomery Clift, Auden, and I mean, Cole Porter, all these people mentioned in your book, name after name after name. And who knew it?
Well,
I think Capote alone was the one who never seemed to hide it.
He didn't talk about it until recent years, I think until the late 70s. But he didn't hide it. Everybody knew it. There was nothing really to say. I once asked him if it had ever bothered him being homosexual, and he said, no, of course not. Why should it? And as far as I could tell, it didn't. I think in a way he was lucky that he was so obviously homosexual, that he was, in other words, stereotypically homosexual, effeminate, and he was tough, I can tell you that, but of course he was effeminate. He liked fancy dress. I don't mean drag or anything like that, but he just liked costumes. He liked colors like violet that men are not supposed to like, that sort of thing. But he was lucky in that he never had an identity crisis. He never had to come out of the closet. Some of his friends from high school and early years, very masculine, handsome fellows, tall. Some of them Truman had brief flings with. I know this because I've talked to some of them. They did suffer identity crises. They got married. They had children. And they became very unhappy. And only in late later years did they come out and really discover who they were. But there was a lot of unhappiness in between for them and for their wives and for their families. Well, Truman never had any of that. So he was very lucky. He did not, however, flaunt homosexuality, I don't believe. He didn't even like the word. He thought it sounded too clinical, and he hated the word gay. He said it was really not appropriate, and he said he couldn't think of a better word, but he said, well, why don't we say yag? Nobody's picked up on that, and I don't think the gay world will ever turn into the yag world. But he had a little bit of a point. But yes, the homosexual world was very influential in the arts then, and still is, as we're discovering with AIDS. If you read the obituaries in Variety, the Hollywood Reporter, the New York Times even, you see how the artistic world is being decimated by this terrible disease. So I don't think things have really changed in that regard.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that you began work on this book about the same time that Capote fell into a decline. Partially, you mentioned that the decline may have resulted from the La Côte-Basque episode. But
well, that accelerated it. It had begun before.
What factors were there, actually, that led to this decline?
I believe it started, and Truman believed it started, with In Cold Blood, which he told me scraped him down to the marrow of his bones. Before that, before In Cold Blood, he said, he had been a relatively sane, stable person. So after In Cold Blood, something snapped, and his gyroscope went out of whack, and he could no longer, his judgment was flawed. He no longer could control himself in the same way he had been able to before. In other words, he was saying that before In Cold Blood, he had the neuroses a lot of us have, but that his life was in control. And it was. All the evidence shows that it was. He suffered some setbacks. He had two flops, for instance, on Broadway, which would have been enough to put a lot of other people under for a long time.
Well, you mentioned the House of Flowers being a flop on Broadway, but it ran 5 months. It's not a flop, is it?
Oh, yes, it was a flop. A lot of people loved it. A lot of people loved his other play, the Grass Harp, as well, which was a straight play. The House of Flowers was a musical. They were both flops, in the sense that they both lost money.
Mm. Even running 5 months?
Yes.
Usually they can tell if it's going to lose money long before 5 months. It's pulled.
No, they were hopeful that it would make money. And they tried again to make a success of it in 1968. Harold Arlen had written the music for it, and it's a wonderful score. I'm sorry people don't listen to it anymore. It's very hard to get the record.
Yeah, that ran, I see, when it was a revival, it was down on Christopher Street.
Right, it was in Greenwich Village. Yeah. They rewrote the second act, which hadn't worked in the Broadway version, which was 1954. But it still didn't work, and that was a flop as well. And people were very sad about it because it did have a lot of fanatical fans, as did the Grass Harp. But still, they were both flops. And Truman had hoped, like Tennessee Williams, to make a lot of money on Broadway, and to, as you can do, and to set himself up, because he really was scratching around for money in those days. He didn't have a great deal.
I guess In Cold Blood changed that.
In Cold Blood changed that. It didn't make him a rich, rich, rich man. I think people outside sometimes exaggerate how much money you can make from a book, but it gave him more success than he could have imagined or could have really hoped for. It was an enormous success. Other books have sold better, but no other book that I can recall in recent history has had the impact of In Cold Blood. People were waiting for the issues of the New Yorker. It was serialized in the New Yorker before it came out as a book. People were running to the newsstands to get the New Yorker to find out what was happening. It had such a huge success that it's really hard to think of anything since then that's been like it. Even The Bonfire of the Vanities, Tom Wolfe's book, which has sold more copies than In Cold Blood did, I don't think has had an equivalent success. The In Cold Blood had an influence on all other writers, all other journalists, I should say, since, whether they know it or not. Certainly Norman Mailer, I'm not sure Norman Mailer would agree with that, so I shouldn't say certainly, but I don't believe Norman Mailer could have written his nonfiction books in the way he did anyway, had it not been for Truman, who led the way. Or the Woodward Bernstein books, the political books, or even Woodward's recent book about the CIA, Veil. And by that I mean that Truman showed writers how they could write in a novelistic sort of way. It had been done before. He wasn't the very first to do it. But he was the first. He did it better than anyone else had done. And he was the first to really make it very popular. And so we're all affected by it. People who have not read In Cold Blood, even, are writing in different ways than they might have, than they would have, had it not been for In Cold Blood.
Now, after Capote died, I was reading a lot of the obituaries, and I was struck by the comments of some of the people who wrote these obituaries. They would say something to the effect that Capote never reached his potential. Now, I can't remember exactly who said that, but I saw that in a number of references.
I saw that many times.
And
I'm
not certain that is the case at all. I don't know what one's potential is in terms of writing. Maybe he didn't, maybe he did, but maybe you could assess the judgment on this.
Well, I think it's a little pretentious for those obituary writers to say that. Huh? Who's to say who's reached his potential?
You'd always tell the obituary writer your obituary didn't rise to its potential.
I think by that, of course, they probably meant that he didn't finish the novel he was working on, Answered Prayers, the one he claimed would be his masterpiece, that he wanted to be the American Proust. And he never finished it. He wrote three chapters, published them, and you can even buy the book now, Answered Prayers, the unfinished novel. But he never finished the thing, and so in that sense, he never reached his potential, and they're right in that regard. But, of course, he did write some wonderful things. He wrote In Cold Blood, which I regard as a masterpiece. But he also wrote many other terrific things. Some of the short stories he wrote when he was in his late teens, early 20s, are wonderful. Have not been, were not surpassed in that time. I believe his first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms, which came out in 1948 when Truman was only 23, is a beautiful book. He himself called it a poetic explosion, and I think that's a very apt phrase. It's a lyrical book, really. It's not a particularly happy book, I don't mean that, but the writing is so rich, so ornate, so baroque, even rococo even. It's the work of a young man, but it's a brilliant work. I don't regard all of his work as so highly. I think that his second novel, The Grass Harp, was really not terribly good. There was some good writing in it, but it was not terribly good. However, Breakfast at Tiffany's, I think, is a perfect social comedy.
And they created one of the best-known heroines in literary fiction,
yes,
Polly
yes,
Golightly.
Yes, and I believe that there's some beautiful pieces, some really perfect pieces, let me go that far, in his last book, Music for Chameleons. They were short pieces for the most part, but the little profile he wrote of Marilyn Monroe I don't think has been surpassed by anyone. Five or six pages it is, that's all. Yet he caught the essence of Marilyn Monroe better than anyone else, I believe, better than all the biographies and memoirs and everything else. And there certainly has been enough written about Marilyn Monroe, but Truman caught her. And there are some other very, very good pieces in that
book.
Well,
we tend to rank writers, and some of those critics in ranking Capote said he was in the second rank of American writers, presumably the top rank would be people like Bello and Malamud, people like that. Where would you put Capote, or is it too premature?
I think it's too early to say. I believe that in the long run, and that may take a few years, I think Truman will be regarded much as Oscar Wilde is regarded, in the sense that Oscar Wilde wrote a few perfect things. The importance of being earnest, Lady Windermere's fan, a few other things.
Dorian Gray.
Oh, Dorian Gray, yes, of course. Not a large body of work, but what he did, and when he was at his very best, it couldn't be better. And I think the same is true of Truman, the pieces I've mentioned. I just don't think could have been any better. But I think he will also be remembered for his life. Oscar Wilde, after all, said that his best work was his life. And I think, in a way, Truman's is in the same league. Certainly the last years of his life were very sad, as indeed Oscar Wilde's were very sad, but the earlier years were very happy. Full of achievement, full of surprise, full of amusement. Truman was amused the world and amused himself. And I would think, I hope that people will remember that as well as the sad part, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
But you know, no one's life ends well. Ours won't end well. Nobody that I've known has died. No death was ever pretty. It just doesn't happen that way. Everybody goes into some form of a decline, or if they're young, then it's a tragedy. So while he did go into a decline, it had to happen somewhere along the line.
I think his was perhaps a little sadder than some others I can think of. I remember P.G. Wodehouse, for instance, who died at the age of, I believe it was 94, and had been really quite healthy up till then, writing too, had a happy life, and was in his doctor's office and just keeled over. Now, I think that's the way to go.
Oh, yeah. At 94, yes. Well, Capote is a wonderful and illuminating biography, Gerald Clark. I know that I learned more about Capote, although he was a vivid character. You filled in details I had no idea about. A wonderful book. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.